Here comes Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo, number 282. The station is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Rebroadcasts are on CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake and CHLS in Lillooet. Join me for an old bugger's half-hour cynical look at our little world. A hearty CFUR welcome to students starting post-secondary studies this week. Special greetings to scholars new to Prince George attending the University of Northern British Columbia and the College of New Caledonia. By now, you should have undergone your orientation and be ready for 4 years, if you're lucky, of life on and off campus in our lovely community. Up here on the hill, orientation of newcomers always includes a session on how to deal with a bear or moose encounter. Local students will not be fazed, but those from southern cities or overseas might be startled by these large animals who share our campus. I trust that new students, both on the hill and down in the valley, will have been warned of some other local hazards. Of course, there are Prince George drivers, but overall they're no worse than most others. People from Asia will have no trouble, as our streets are pretty tame compared to theirs at home. Then there's the local substitute for air. Arrivals from Beijing or Los Angeles may ignore this warning, but those from other areas should take heed. Accustom yourself to constant irritation of the lungs and eyes. The odor is harmless and just the smell of money, according to a former mayor. As one exchange student from urban China once said, "I am uncomfortable breathing something I can't see." You may soon feel the same. Exchange students from Baghdad or Kabul could skip the part of orientations dealing with venturing downtown. One must be wary on central Prince George streets. Do not wear colors or styles that might lead others to believe you are affiliated with certain unsavory groups. Such misidentification could result in bodily harm. It's suggested that one utilize protective coloration when venturing into the town's core. For men, it would behoove you to look as nerdy as possible. Women should wear long dresses and head coverings, closely resembling the garb of a strict religious sect. Both males and females would be wise to ostentatiously carry thick textbooks to identify yourselves as non-combatants. Buses can take you to the Pine Center Mall Shopping Center or to the Mortgage Heights, where most of your needs can be satisfied in relative safety. There was one wee event at the mall around Christmas time, but no bystanders were injured. For those insisting on venturing downtown, I recommend that you shop first in your college or university campus store, both of which carry a full line of Kevlar accessories. Welcome to our little community, and good luck. On behalf of this station, I urge everyone in the student community to join me by trying your hand at broadcasting. It takes no experience, no talent, obviously, and it will give you a chance to sit safely behind Lexan in our spacious new studio. Besides looking good on a resume, broadcasting introduces one to the exercise of preparing to express thoughts in English. You can't text on air, and the normal run of high school speech is best shorn of meaningless fillers to avoid sounding ridiculous. It will be a help in your coming class assignments to be able to put your thoughts on paper, then reducing the volume by half by excising all of the likes, you knows, I means, and such. I especially welcome anyone who would like to present a talk show, preferably countering my own cynical, critical, and outrageous socialistic atheistic diatribes. As Doug Strachan knows, I present a broad target. What the hell do you have to lose but your time? Students new to UNBC may find their classes held in either the Canfor or Weldwood lecture theaters. Most will be familiar with Canfor, but what's a Weldwood? Once upon a time, when this campus was built, there were two competing giant forestry corporations in British Columbia, Canfor and Weldwood. A few years ago, our government, in its wisdom, allowed Canfor to swallow its competitor. I attended a local dog and pony show put on by Canfor at the time. A suit addressed an apprehensive audience, assuring the community there would be no negative effects on the local community resulting from the loss of competition. A member of the audience asked whether Canfor would eliminate the support that defunct Weldwood have given to local community organizations and charities. The suit assured us that Canfor's future contributions would match those of the combined support of its two components. This was, of course, bullshit all the way. Canfor eliminated redundant jobs and cut funding. Companies do not merge unless they foresee reduction of both costs and competition. The Canfor-Weldwood marriage was no different. This summer, a drastic fire eliminated Canfor's plywood mill, along with a couple of 100 well-paid union jobs. After a suitable delay so that executives could unload their Prince George homes, the company announced that it would not rebuild this plant and that those jobs were lost forever. This decision was naturally papered over with a promise that insurance money would be used to enhance other operations in the North. It remains to be seen whether this promise was more eyewash, and I am suspicious. As to the support of local organizations, Canfor has now dropped out as a major support of the local live theater scene. Past support was generous, and we all appreciate it, but the sudden halt hurts. I assume that Canfor contributions to other local endeavors has likewise been eliminated. But Canfor is not alone in reducing contributions to the arts in Prince George. Both Tim Hortons and Petro-Canada have bowed out of support for this local theatrical project. Neither corporation has the excuse of a collapsing industry or lack of profits. The reasons given were that they will be directing funding toward advertising and sponsorships in the 2010 Olympic exercise in Vancouver, Whistler. This is just a taste of the social cost we'll be forced to swallow as funds are diverted from social and economic needs of the North to subsidize overpriced, oversized jock palaces in the Lower Mainland. Once the games commence, we will see the immense expense of operating this fiasco while providing it with a stultifying amount of security. Gordon Campbell promised that all of British Columbia would benefit from the 2010 Olympics. And how, pray tell, will the North benefit as tourists are diverted to Vancouver, our taxes paid for their venues, while our services are cut? The cost estimates for the Beijing Olympics, now thankfully concluded, run to $60 billion. Do Harper and Campbell intend to match that or top that figure? With inflation threatening to take off, it may be easier than they thought. Already they expect the opening ceremonies to cost $60 million, of which the feds will pay a third, as long as they represent Canadian conservative ideals. Now Harper's come up with a new idea. He wants to have Hitler's legacy, the big torch relay, to be led by surviving Canadian veterans of the Afghan fiasco. I have a further suggestion. Let's have the 2010 Paralympics led by maimed veterans of Afghanistan. That would provide a nice balance. Jackboots, anyone? Canadian provincial and federal governments are rushing headlong towards selling off and privatizing everything in sight at the expense of our environment, safety, and health. Harper's answer to listeria bacteria contamination in meat products is to turn surveillance of meat factories over to corporate management. Campbell's response to ferry breakdowns, overpaid executives, and rising fares is further privatization. Harper's answer to poor postal service and rising rates is further contraction of core employment with more outlets in the back of drugstores and transient contractors handling delivery. Campbell's carrying on with his program of closing public seniors' residences and moving the aged infirm to institutions run, not for oldsters, but for profit. Tales of neglect and abuse in these corporate warehouses will not deter him. Campbell and his supporters have the money to afford a decent place for themselves and their loved ones when they become infirm. It's just come to light that the Ministry of Environment has been emasculated. Under current regulations, private companies clean up toxic spills, then certify their own results. This ministry was created to guard public health and protect our natural environment for our descendants. It is not designed to act as a front for those who allow despoiling of British Columbia behind a corporate mask. Will some party please come forth and forcefully act to restore public services to the position where they belong, in the hands of public servants? Harper wants to call an election in violation of the intent of his own fixed-date legislation, but he faces a problem. His faithful handlers and advisors, the ones who would target Dion and Layton with the worst of attack ads, are busy until November slinging mud for McCain. Yes, the brain trust plotting for the American Republicans and the Canadian Conservatives is one and the same bunch. They champion the same causes, subverting democracy and enriching their masters. American know-how in manipulating the public with fear, superstition, and jingoism is expertly exercised south of the border to keep right-wingers in power. Harper proved the Canadians are not immune to the same tactics. In any case, it will be difficult for Canada's Conservatives to round up such a brutal, unprincipled domestic bunch of gangsters as McCain is able to down there. Well, we have been grooming our own propagandists at the Fraser Institute and a few other propaganda mills, so I guess the coming election will not be tame by any standards. American masters of the attack ads and dirty tricks have a job ahead of them. They have to sell the average American on the idea that it's better to be represented by McCain than Obama in the face of a flood of facts. McCain is supposed to be a war hero, as if that title is earned by dropping bombs on peasant villages and then returning for a hot meal while your victims burn. He's like the guy who wins second prize in a fist fight. He was shot down and remained a prisoner of the Vietnamese for years, a situation that speaks well for the Vietnamese in keeping him alive no matter what the conditions. For many of the locals, life was no better. American voters have to be diverted from suspecting that McCain suffered severe mental trauma from his years as prisoner. Not that he is a Manchurian candidate, but such a long incarceration does not lend itself to increased mental stability. Stories are leaking out about McCain's display of temper, a characteristic that I don't welcome in a man with his finger on the nuclear button. Obama is no prize, but from my perspective, he certainly seems the lesser of two evils. The men and women who labor to polish McCain's image while denigrating Obama's are busy preventing the American public from agreeing with me. McDonald's Corporation paid $70 million to buy the title Official Restaurant at the Beijing Olympic Games. They built several on site, including the main one in the Olympic Village, which claimed to be the largest McDonald's in the world. Athletes were offered free fare at any of these facilities. By a strange coincidence, more than a dozen athletes complimented McDonald's on their fast food and admitted having eaten there. Statements to the press, including one by Usain Bolt, winner of the 100-meter race. He claimed that he dined on Chicken McNuggets before winning the race. Other athletes said they ate at McDonald's joints after competing as a celebration. Now, I don't want to sound cynical or incredulous, but I suspect there's more to these uniformly favorable statements than is admitted by McDonald's or athletes. It's suspicious and statistically improbable that there have been no negative comments, and so many compliments just happen to have been dropped in interviews. I suspect that investigation would reveal a quid pro quo behind these statements. Maybe it was not in writing, maybe just knowledge passed by word of mouth that the corporation would not be ungrateful to those making kindly comments. I cannot believe that the world's top athletes, those who train for years and whose diets have been fine-tuned to maximize performance, would break training to fill up on junk food, especially before competitions. These athletes' statements have been worth millions to McDonald's as advertising. It's hard to accept that McDonald's gratitude would not be expressed in material form, either now or in future considerations. Does this sound cynical? If so, is it cynical of me or of McDonald's? With Beijing safely behind us, I hope for some relief from breathless reporting of Olympic nonsense until we become immersed in the hoopla for Vancouver. No such luck. CBC has already begun reporting on the next Summer Olympics to be held in London. Good grief, will it never end? That was a rhetorical question, as we all know that it will not. Information about these athletic exhibitions is easy to come by and easy to report. As the media slash spending and disband news bureaus to save money, they're drawn to report on easy stuff in place of real news. War news comes from tame reporters schlepped around at government expense and fed with handouts from public relations specialists. More and more what we hear and see as news is just raw or rehashed press releases and film clips supplied by friendly officials and corporations. Sports news is cheaper to report than real news of real events. Investigative journalism is expensive and labor-intensive. How much simpler to just feed the public's curiosity for the trivial with reports of children's games and canned propaganda cranked out by publicists for entertainers. Of course, as ever more concentrated media focus on the trivial, the public is, in a democracy, loses the ability and the will to learn enough of current events to participate meaningfully in a democracy. Look at the rubbish that fills the media in the run-up to any election. There was a time when politicians took to the stump and tried to woo voters with lengthy speeches outlining their policies. No more. Neither the media nor the public will tolerate complex policy statements. They want clichés and trite comments that can be kept under 30 seconds. Do we really know what our conservatives or liberals propose if either gains a majority in Parliament? When one party or the other advocates a program or change to win votes and actually follows through, it can be a disaster for the party, the government, or the public. Take the conservative attack on the GST, which was, of course, inflicted on us by our hero Brian Mulroney. But never mind. They promised to cut that hated tax from 7% to 5%, and surprise of surprises, they actually did. But the federal government relied on this tax to supplement other taxes which it had slashed, so our economy was stimulated at a time when it needed cooling, and government slipped from surplus to deficit, at least temporarily. Stéphane Dion put forward a plan for a carbon tax, whose proceeds would be used to cut emissions and fund steps moving Canada toward a sustainable energy economy. The plan was too complex for that 30-second soundbite, so it became an easy target for conservative attacks. Dion is challenged to explain his green shift in 15 seconds or give it up. No, successful campaigns now focus on perceived failings of the opposition. People will hold their noses and vote for those they see as least bad for their immediate gratification. Mudslinging is the order of the day. One slip of the tongue, like Obama's reference to his new running mate as the next president of the United States, and McCain's propagandists make big hay of it. Obama's handlers did not miss out on McCain's inability to state how many homes he owns. Neither of these slips bears any relation to how either man would guide the United States and the world out of some serious dangers we all face. Nor will we soon learn what we are being asked to vote for in any of our elections, federal, provincial, or state. It's not a great step to propose that our Western version of democracy is not working. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. An old friend, now deceased, was a far-left fan of the Soviet Empire. He expressed his loyalty by buying a Skoda car, a product of the socialist paradise of Czechoslovakia. It was a piece of crap that gave him nothing but trouble until the day it was towed to the junkyard. It's a fool whose buying decisions are based on ideology unless other factors are roughly equal. I make it a rule that I will not shop at Malwart because there's nothing they sell that's not available elsewhere where wages and benefits are better for employees. I prefer union-made products to those made under inferior conditions. I'll buy local produce over imported when it's available at competitive prices. Whenever I find something that is actually made in North America or Europe, I will favor it over something made in an Asian sweatshop. I say this as Doug Strachan accused me of hypocrisy for buying a Toyota assembled in a non-union factory. Yes, I bought a Toyota Matrix that was put together by non-union workers. I suppose I should have been loyal to organized labor by purchasing a good old Hummer, that gas-guzzling, environmentally destructive dinosaur, from every working man's friend, Generous Motors. For the information of listeners, the Matrix is made in Ontario, and I don't think its workers are too oppressed or they would have joined the Canadian auto workers long ago. I say this as a former member of the United Auto Workers in the States. I spent a summer working on Ford pickup trucks on an assembly line in New Jersey. I recommend the experience to anyone who wants to see how dehumanizing labor can be. We were sweated for endless hours for which we earned the princely sum of $1.92 an hour. During my Ford orientation, I asked if there was a phone number to call if I was too sick to work. They told me that the line started at 7 a.m. and I was to be there or be fired. If I was unable to work, there'd be a doctor on site to determine that. I heard tales of men coming in by ambulance to avoid losing their precious jobs. One of my co-workers suffered a head cut that bled profusely, but he had to continue working until a replacement could jump in and cover him. The line produced a new truck every 90 seconds, and a minute's shutdown cost the company thousands of dollars, dollars more important than the health and safety of the men actually doing the hard work. In 3 months' work on that assembly line, I never saw any engineers or other experts except for time and motion men, who worked constantly to consolidate operations, squeezing the greatest work from the smallest number of workers. And the operative standard, in spite of an advertising campaign claiming that the quality goes in before the name goes on, was shiny side up and out the door. Defects and missing parts were the dealer's problem, and then the customer's. I've read that Toyota, like other Japanese companies, put their engineers down on the shop floor, talking to workers and looking for problems. Whereas we strove to get the maximum number of vehicles out the door, their goal was to get the best products out to customers. I learned of Japanese standards when I bought our first Toyota 22 years ago. I picked it up in Vancouver and took it directly to my Prince George mechanics, telling them to go over it and make a list of problems that I could have adjusted immediately under warranty. They went from bumper to bumper and claimed they could not find so much as a loose bolt. I still drive that truck. No, Doug, I'll not buy the North American product, nor a European one for that matter, just because it's union-made, and I make no apologies for that. In fact, our last car was a used Mercedes, which we finally donated to the College of New Caledonia's auto mechanic training program, as it gave us so much trouble. I have my principles, but they do not extend to buying junk for ideological reasons. As Americans prepare for their November election, Bush's government assures them that victory over Iraq is in sight so their soldiers can be shifted to Afghanistan to finish defeating that poor nation. But what does victory in Iraq mean to planners in the White House and Pentagon? Would triumph be indicated by a degree of security for locals and foreigners in Baghdad, similar to that of a typical American city, like perhaps Miami or the Bronx? Actually, the pattern is clear. Victory would see most of Iraq left to its own resources, with various sects and warlords free to carry on their skirmishes and vendettas. Americans will certainly remain insulated and protected from their hosts in fortified bunkers strategically placed to oversee oil facilities while assuring that the locals don't recover an independence that would give them power to boot their guests out. Exxon, Chevron, and Shell will be safe behind American soldiers and assorted mercenaries. Diplomats, CIA operatives, and assorted hangers-on will remain in that huge Baghdad castle with 21 reinforced buildings constructed on 104 acres of what was once one of Saddam's palaces. This $600 million monstrosity, built humorously as an embassy, is actually a fortress constructed with the goal of being a self-contained island in a hostile sea. This facility, actually a city within a city, contains 619 blast-resistant apartments, a food court, a swimming pool, and a full range of entertainment for residents, secure with their own supplies of water and electricity. Residents of this embassy are safely insulated from the realities of the surrounding streets, populated by those Iraqis whose lifestyles they have destroyed and whose resources Americans have appropriated. One day we may see helicopters rising from the helipads of this monstrosity, carrying the last American refugees from the wrath of their host nation. I will shed no tears. We should not be surprised that a maple leaf meat plant in Toronto is spreading disease. The federal government has cut back on food inspection for years, ever since the Food Inspection Agency was given the job of promoting foods in conflict with its core mission of protecting Canadians from dangerous products. What has come as a shock to those checking the recall list is the number of different brands, supposedly competitors, that are manufactured by this one maple leaf plant. Try this: Artisan Collection, Best Value, Bittner's, Schneider's, Burns, Campfire, Compliments, Courish, Country Morning, Deli Gourmet, Equality, Harmony, Hickory Farms, High Grade, Kirkland, Main Street Deli, Maple Leaf, Mayfair, Mitchell's, Olympic, Overlander, Parma, Shopsies, Butcher's Cut, and a number of generic meats. Why all the different names? Because Maple Leaf has been buying up other meat processors, maintaining their brand names and preserving the illusion of competition. Corporations in many fields are doing the same. Walk through any large mall and look at the various small clothing stores. Most of them are owned by a handful of huge conglomerates, maintaining the impression of fighting for markets while actually colluding to prevent competition from independence. Looking at all this cross-ownership and layers of corporations owning one another begs the question of why this is allowed. Originally, a corporation was granted a charter to engage in one specific field. The corporation would succeed or fail in its area, and failure resulted in dissolution. Only in fairly recent history has one chartered corporation been permitted to take over another. In my vision of a perfect world, Unilever Corporation would not be allowed to buy Breyers ice cream to join its field of other brands in eliminating competition. If Unilever wants to produce ice cream, it can damn well put its own name on the product. Likewise with Kraft and any number of other conglomerates. We have no idea how little real competition exists in our capitalist marketplace. Until we have some serious reforms in government control, we'll continue to have little real choice as consumers. An annoying assertion made by conservatives and echoed by Doug Strachan is that government should be run like businesses. This is patent nonsense. Businesses are established and run to make a profit from providing goods and services. Stockholder-owned corporations are mandated, by law, to put profit for their owners above all other functions. Putting public service above income leaves directors of these corporations open to lawsuits and from stockholders. Crown corporations have the same form as private companies, but they're owned by governments and operate to provide a function in the public interest. A crown may exist to operate in a field where competition is not practical. A public company delivers the mail, a service that would not be profitable if more than one entity tried to duplicate it. A crown corporation was established to run British Columbia's ferry system as an extension of our highways to the islands. British Columbia Railway was built by government to extend development to the north when private companies would not. And Petro-Canada was assembled to give government a window into the enterprise of extracting and developing Canada's energy supplies when foreign companies held a stranglehold on us and refused to be accountable to the public. BC Hydro was to extend electricity beyond the cities and into the countryside when private companies were not interested. When a crown corporation makes money for the government, such as Doug's example of the BC Lottery Corporation, it would be a foolish leader who would wish to sell it off. I will take him at his word on that. But governments do sell off profitable crowns, don't they? The right-wing government of Saskatchewan sold off the Potash Corporation that was making money hand over fist. Why? To give it to give their friends in industry to profit from. The same with BC Rail, Petro-Canada, Canadian National. Why do governments disband public services and fire public employees, then contract out those same services to private interests, which provide poorer service at higher prices? That one is simple. Public employees with unions have job security and no necessary loyalty to the party in power. However, contracted employees rely on a friendly government to keep their jobs and can thus be blackmailed. There are no legislated ceilings on executive salaries for contractors, so their hotshots will work and contribute to the party that will maintain their contracts. It's relatively hard and time-consuming to build a crown corporation with a structure and assets to fill a public need, but it takes just some closed-door bargaining and a simple legislative act to give away the fruits of that collective effort. This is what Harper, Campbell, and other corporate-friendly leaders across our globalized economy are doing as we speak. 21st-century conservatives are destroyers, not builders in the fashion of previous real conservatives who had principles. This is the 282nd closing of the Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Catch rebroadcasts on CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake and CHLS in Lillooet.